Disc 8.
Another agent posing as a locksmith followed the carpenter and changed every lock in the building. Their agreement included the provision that Trevor would see no new clients for at least the next 30 days. He'd argued long and hard against this, as if he had a stellar reputation to protect. Think of all the people who might need him, he'd complained. But they knew how slow the last 30 days had been, and they pressed him until he conceded. They wanted the place to themselves. Chap called those clients with scheduled appointments and told them that Mr. Carson would be tied up in court on the day they were supposed to stop by. Rescheduling would be difficult, Chap explained, but he'd give them a call when there was a break in the action.
I didn't think he went to court, one of them said.
Oh, yes, Chap said. It's a really big case. When the client list was pared to the core, only one case required an office visit. It was an ongoing child support matter, and Trevor had represented the woman for 3 years. He couldn't simply give her the boot. Jan stopped by to cause trouble and brought with her a boyfriend of sorts. He was a wiry young man with a goatee, polyester pants, white shirt and tie, and Chap figured he probably sold used cars. No doubt he could have easily thrashed Trevor, but he wanted no part of Chap.
I'd like to speak to Trevor, she said, her eyes darting around her newly organized desk.
Sorry, he's in a meeting.
And who the hell are you?
I'm a paralegal.
Yeah, well, get your money up front.
Thank you.
Your things are in those two boxes over there, Chap said, pointing.
She noticed the magazine racks were purged and neat, the wastebasket was empty, the furniture had been polished. There was a smell of antiseptic, as if they'd fumigated the place where she'd once sat. She was no longer needed.
Tell Trevor he owes me $1,000 in unpaid salary, she said.
I will, Chap replied. Anything else?
Yeah. That new client yesterday, Yates Newman? Tell Trevor I checked the newspapers. In the past 2 weeks, there's been no accident deaths on I-95. No record of a female named Newman getting killed either. Something's up.
Thank you. I'll tell him. She looked around for the last time and smirked again when she saw the new door. Her boyfriend glared at Chap as if he might just step over and break his neck anyway, but the glaring was done as he headed for the door. They left without breaking anything, both of them carrying a box as they lumbered down the sidewalk. Chap watched them leave, then began preparing for the challenge of lunch. Dinner the night before had been nearby, at a crowded new seafood place 2 blocks from the Sea Turtle Inn. Given the size of the portions, the prices were outrageous, and that was exactly why Trevor, the newest millionaire in Jacksonville, had insisted they eat there. Of course, the evening was on him, and he spared no expense. He was drunk after the first martini and didn't remember what he ate. Wes and Chap had explained that their client did not allow them to drink. They sipped designer water and kept his wine glass full.
"I'd find me another client," Trevor said, laughing at his own humor.
"Guess I'll have to drink for all three of us," he said halfway through dinner, then proceeded to do just that.
Much to their relief, they learned that he was a docile drunk. They kept pouring in an effort to see how far he would go. He got quieter and lower in his seat, and long after dessert he tipped the waiter $300 in cash. They helped him to their car and drove him home. He slept with the new briefcase across his chest. When Wes turned off his light, Trevor was lying on his bed in his rumpled pants and white cotton shirt, bow tie undone, shoes still on, snoring and clutching the briefcase tightly with both arms. The wire had arrived just before 5. The money was in place. Klockner had told them to get him drunk, see how he behaved in that condition, then start working in the morning. At 7:30 a.m., they returned to his house, unlocked the door with their key, and found him pretty much as they'd left him. One shoe was off, and he was curled on his side, with the briefcase tucked away like a football.
Let's go!" Chap had yelled,
while Wes turned on lights and raised shades and made as much noise as possible. Trevor, to his credit, scrambled from bed, raced to the bathroom, took a quick shower, and 20 minutes later walked into his den with a fresh bow tie and not a wrinkle anywhere. His eyes were slightly swollen, but he was smiling and determined to tackle the day. The $1 million helped. In fact, he'd never conquered a hangover as quickly. They had a quick muffin and strong coffee at Beach Java, then attacked his little office with vigor. While Chap took care of the front, Wes kept Trevor in his office. Some of the pieces had fallen into place over dinner. The names of the brethren had finally been extracted from Trevor, and Wes and Chap had done a splendid job of being surprised. "Three judges?" they'd both repeated in apparent disbelief. Trevor had smiled and nodded with great pride, as if he and he alone had been the architect of this masterful scheme. He wanted them to believe that he'd had the brains and skill to convince three former judges that they should spend their time writing letters to lonely gay men so he, Trevor, could rake off a third of their extortion. Hell, he was practically a genius. Other pieces of the puzzle remained unclear, and Wes was determined to keep Trevor locked away until he had answers. "Let's talk about Quince Garby," he said. "His post office box was rented to a fake corporation. How'd you learn his true identity?" "It was easy," Trevor said, very proud of himself. Not only was he a genius now, but he was a very rich one. He had awakened yesterday morning with a headache and had spent the first half hour in bed, worrying about his gambling losses, worrying about his dwindling law practice, worrying about his increasing reliance on the brethren and their scam. 24 hours later, he'd awakened with a worse headache, but one soothed with the balm of $1 million. He was euphoric, giddy, and anxious to finish the task at hand so he could get on with life. "I found a private investigator in Des Moines," he said, sipping coffee, his feet on his desk where they belonged. "Sent him a check for $1,000. He spent 2 days in Baker's. You been to Baker's?" "Yep." "I was afraid I'd have to go. The scam works best if you can snare some prominent guy with money. He'll pay anything to keep you quiet. Anyway, this investigator found a postal clerk who needed some money. She was a single mother, house full of kids, old car, small apartment, you get the picture. He called her at night and said he'd give her $500 cash if she could tell him who was renting Box 788 in the name of CMT Investments. Next morning, he called her at the post office. They met in a parking lot during her lunch break. She gave him a piece of paper with the name of Quince Garby, and he gave her an envelope with five $100 bills. She never asked who he was." "Is that a typical method?" "It worked with Garby. Curtis Cates, the guy in Dallas, the second one we scammed, was a little more complicated. The investigator we hired there couldn't find anyone on the inside, so he had to watch the post office for 3 days. Cost $1,800, but they finally saw him and got his license number." "Who's next?" "Probably this guy in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania. His alias is Brant White, and he appears to be a hot prospect." "Do you ever read the letters?" "Never. I don't know what's being said back and forth. Don't want to know. When they're ready to bust somebody, they'll tell me to scope out the box and get a real name. That's if their pen pal is using a front, like your client, Mr. Conyers. You'd be amazed how many men use their real names. Unbelievable." "Do you know when they send the extortion letters?" "Oh, yeah. They tell me so I can alert the bank in the Bahamas that a wire might be on the way. The bank calls me as soon as the money hits." "Tell me about this Brant White in Upper Darby," Wes said. He was taking pages of notes as if something might be missed. Every word was being recorded on 4 different machines across the street. "They're ready to bust him. That's all I know. He seems hot to trot because they've just swapped a couple of letters. Some of these guys, it's like pulling teeth, judging by the number of letters." "But you don't keep track of the letters. There are no records here. I was afraid the feds would show up one day with a search warrant, and I wanted no evidence of my involvement." "Smart. Very smart." Trevor smiled and savored his shrewdness. "Yeah, well, I've done a lot of criminal law. After a while, you start thinking like a criminal. Anyway, I've been unable to find the right investigator in the Philadelphia area. Still working on it, though." Brant White was a Langley creation. Trevor could hire every investigator in the Northeast, and they'd never find a real person behind the post office box. "In fact," he continued, "I was preparing to go up there myself when I got the call from Spicer telling me to go to Washington and track down Al Conyers. Then you guys showed up and, well, the rest is history." His words trailed away as he once again thought of the money. Sure, it was a coincidence that Wes and Chap entered his life just hours after he was supposed to go searching for their client, but he didn't care. He could hear the seagulls and feel the hot sand. He could hear the reggae from the island bands and feel the wind pushing his little boat. "Is there another contact on the outside?" Wes asked. "Oh, no," he said vainly. "I don't need any help. The fewer people involved, the easier the operation works."
"Very smart," Wes said. Trevor leaned back even deeper in his chair. The ceiling above him was cracked and peeling and in need of a fresh coat of enamel. A couple of days ago, that might have worried him. Now he knew it would never get painted, not if they expected him to foot the bill. He'd walk out of the place one day very soon, once Wes and Chap here had finished with the brethren. He'd spend a day or two boxing up his files to store for what reason he was not certain, and he'd give away his outdated and unused law books. He'd find some broke rookie fresh out of law school and looking for a few crumbs around city court, and he'd sell him the furniture and computer for a very reasonable price. And when all the loose ends were covered, he, L. Trevor Carson, attorney and counselor at law, would walk out of the office and never look back. What a glorious day that would be. Chap interrupted the brief daydream with a sack of tacos and soft drinks. Lunch had not been discussed among the three, but Trevor had already been checking his watch in anticipation of another long meal at Pete's. He grudgingly took a taco and seethed for a moment. He needed a drink. "I think it's a good idea to lay off the booze during lunch," Chap said as they huddled around Trevor's desk and tried not to spill black beans and ground beef.
"Do as you please," Trevor said.
"I was talking to you," Chap said, "at least for the next 30 days.
That wasn't part of our deal. It is now. You need to be sober and alert."
"Why exactly?"
"Because our client wants you that way, and he's paying you $1 million.
Does he want me to floss twice a day and eat my spinach?"
"I'll ask him."
"Tell him to kiss my ass while you're at it."
"Don't overreact, Trevor," Wes said. "Just cut back on the drinking for a few days. It'll be good for you."
If the money had set him free, these two were beginning to choke him. They'd now spent 24 hours together, and they showed no signs of leaving. In fact, the opposite was happening. They were moving in. Chap left early to collect the mail. They'd convinced Trevor that he'd been very sloppy in his habits, and that's how they'd tracked him so easily. Suppose other victims were lurking out there. Trevor had had little trouble in finding the real names of their victims. Why couldn't the victims do the same to the person behind Aladdin North and Laurel Ridge? From now on, Wes and Chap would take turns collecting the mail. They'd mix things up, visit the post offices at different times, use disguises, real cloak and dagger stuff. Trevor eventually agreed. They seemed to know what they were doing. There were 4 letters for Ricky waiting in the Neptune Beach post office, and 2 for Percy in Atlantic Beach. Chap quickly made the rounds with a team behind him, watching anyone who might be watching him. The letters were taken to the rental, where they were quickly opened and copied, then put back together. The copies were read and analyzed by agents anxious to have something to do. Klockner read them, too. Of the 6, they'd seen 5 of the names before. All were lonely, middle-aged men trying to muster the nerve to take the next step with Ricky or Percy. None seemed particularly aggressive. One wall in a converted bedroom of the rental had been painted white, and a large map of the 50 states had been stenciled on it. Red pushpins were used to mark Ricky's pen pals, green for Percy. The names and hometowns of the correspondents were printed in black under the pins. The nets were getting wider. Ricky had 23 men actively writing him, Percy 18. 30 states were represented. The brethren were fine-tuning their venture with each passing week. They were now running ads in 3 magazines, as far as Klockner could tell. They held firm to their profile, and by the 3rd letter they usually knew if a new guy had any money. Or a wife. It was a fascinating game to watch, and now that they had complete access to Trevor, they wouldn't miss a letter. The day's mail was summarized in 2 pages, then given to an agent who took off to Langley. DeVille had it in hand by 7 p.m. The first call of the afternoon at 3:10 came when Chap was washing windows. Wes was still in Trevor's office, grilling him with one question after another. Trevor was weary. He'd missed his nap, and he desperately needed a drink. "Law office?" Chap answered. "Is this Trevor's office?" the caller asked. "It is. Who's calling?"
"Who are you?"
"I'm Chap, the new paralegal."
"What happened to the girl?"
"She no longer works here. What can I do for you?"
"This is Joe Roy Spicer. I'm a client of Trevor's, and I'm calling from Trumbull."
"Calling from where?"
"Trumbull. It's a federal prison. Is Trevor there?"
"No, sir. He's in Washington, and he should be back here in a couple of hours."
"Okay. Tell him I'll call back at 5.
"Yes, sir." Chap hung up and took a deep breath, as did Klockner across the street. The CIA had just had its first live contact with one of the Brethren. The second call came at exactly 5. Chap answered the phone and recognized the voice. Trevor was waiting in his office.
"Hello?" "Trevor, this is Joe Roy Spicer."
"Hello, Judge."
"What'd you find in Washington?"
"We're still working on it. It's going to be a tough one, but we'll find him." There was a long pause, as if Spicer didn't like this news and was uncertain about how much to say.
"Are you coming tomorrow?"
"I'll be there at 3.
"Bring $5,000 cash."
"$5,000?
"That's what I said. Get the money and bring it here, all in 20s and 50s.
"What are you going to do?"
"Don't ask stupid questions, Trevor. Bring the damn money. Put it in an envelope with other mail. You've done it before."
"All right." Spicer hung up without another word. Then Trevor spent an hour discussing the economics of Trumbull. Cash was prohibited. Every inmate had a job, and his wages were credited to his account. Expenditures such as long-distance calls, commissary charges, copying expenses, stamps, were all debited against his account. But cash was present, though seldom seen. It was smuggled in and hidden, and it was used to pay gambling debts and bribe guards for small favors. Trevor was afraid of it. If he, as the attorney, got caught sneaking it in, his visiting privileges would be permanently eliminated. He'd smuggled on 2 previous occasions, both times $500, in 10s and 20s. He couldn't imagine what they wanted with $5,000. Chapter 28. After 3 days of stepping over and around Wes and Chap, Trevor needed a break. They wanted breakfast, lunch, and dinner together. They wanted to drive him home and pick him up for work very early in the morning. They were running what was left of his practice, Chap the paralegal, Wes the office manager, both of them drilling him with endless questions because there was precious little lawyering to be done. So it was no surprise when they announced they would drive him to Trumbull. He didn't need a driver, he explained. He'd made the trip many times in his trusty little Beetle, and he'd go it alone. This upset them, and they threatened to call their client for guidance. "Call the damned client, for all I care," Trevor yelled at them, and they backed down. "Your client is not running my life." But the client was, and they all knew it. Only the money mattered now. Trevor had already performed his Judas act. He left Neptune Beach in his Beetle alone, followed by Wes and Chap in their rental car, and behind them was a white van occupied by people Trevor would never see. Nor did he want to see them. Just for the hell of it, he made a sudden turn into a convenience store for a 6-pack and laughed when the rest of the caravan slammed on brakes and barely avoided a wreck. Once out of town, he drove painfully slow, sipping his beer, savoring his privacy, telling himself he could suffer through the next 30 days. He could suffer through anything. For $1 million. As he neared the village of Trumbull, he had the first pangs of guilt. Could he pull this off? He was about to face Spicer, a client who trusted him, a prisoner who needed him, a partner in crime. Could he keep a straight face and act as if things were fine, while every word was being captured by a high-frequency mic in his briefcase? Could he swap letters with Spicer as if nothing had changed, knowing that the mail was being monitored? Plus, he was throwing away his law career, something he'd worked hard to attain and had once been proud of. He was selling his ethics, his standards, even his morals for money. Was his soul worth $1 million? Too late now. The money was in the bank. He took a sip of beer and washed away the fading twinges of guilt. Spicer was a crook, and so were Beach and Yarber, and he, Trevor Carson, was just as culpable. There's no honor among thieves, he kept repeating silently. Link got a whiff of the beer wafting off Trevor as they walked down the hall and into the visitors' area. At the lawyer's room, Trevor looked inside. He saw Spicer, partially hidden by a newspaper, and was suddenly nervous. What kind of low-life lawyer carries an electronic listening device into a confidential meeting with a client? The guilt hit Trevor like a brick, but there was no turning back. The mic was almost as big as a golf ball and had been meticulously installed by Wes in the bottom of Trevor's beaten-up and scruffy black leather briefcase. It was extremely powerful and would easily transmit everything to the faceless boys in the white van. Wes and Chap were there, too, ready with their earphones, anxious to hear it all. "Afternoon, Joe Roy," Trevor said.
"Same to you," Spicer said.
"Let me see the briefcase," Link said.
He gave a cursory look, then said,
"It looks fine."
Trevor had warned Wes and Chap that Link sometimes took a peek into the briefcase. The mic was covered by a pile of papers.
"Here's the mail," Trevor said.
"How many?"
Link asked.
8.
"You got any?"
Link asked Spicer.
"No, none today," Spicer replied.
"I'll be outside," Link said.
The door closed, feet shuffled, and suddenly there was silence. A very long silence. Nothing. Not a word between lawyer and client. They waited in the white van for an eternity until it was obvious something had gone wrong. As Link stepped from the small room, Trevor quickly and deftly set the briefcase outside the door on the floor, where it rested benignly during the remainder of the attorney-client conference. Link noticed it and thought nothing about it.
"What'd you do that for?" Spicer asked.
"It's empty," Trevor said, shrugging. "Let the closed circuit see it. We have nothing to hide."
Trevor had had one final brief attack of ethics. Maybe he'd bug the next chat with his client, but not this one. He'd simply tell Wes and Chap that the guard took his briefcase, something that happened occasionally.
"Whatever,"
Spicer said, riffling through the mail until he came to two envelopes that were slightly thicker.
"Is this the money?"
"It is. I had to use some hundreds."
"Why? I plainly said 20s and 50s.
"That's all I could find, okay? I didn't anticipate needing that much cash."
Joe Roy studied the addresses on the other letters. Then he asked, rather caustically,
"So what happened in Washington?"
"It's a tough one. One of those rent-a-box outfits in the suburbs. Open 24 hours, 7 days a week, always somebody on duty, lots of traffic. Security is tight. We'll figure it out."
"Who are you using?"
"Some outfit in Chevy Chase."
"Give me a name."
"What do you mean, give me a name?"
"Give me the name of the investigator in Chevy Chase."
Trevor drew a blank. Invention failed him. Spicer was on to something, his dark, liquid eyes glowing with intensity.
"I can't remember," Trevor said.
"Where'd you stay?"
"What is this, Joe Roy?"
"Give me the name of your hotel."
"Why?"
"I have the right to know. I'm the client. I'm paying for your expenses. Where did you stay?"
"Ritz-Carlton."
"Which one?"
"I don't know, the Ritz-Carlton."
"There are two. Which one was it?"
"I don't know."
"What flight did you take?"
"Come on, Joe Roy, what is this?"
"What airline?"
"Delta."
"The flight number?"
"I don't remember."
"You got back yesterday, less than 24 hours ago. What was your flight number?"
"I don't recall."
"Are you sure you went to Washington?"
"Of course I went,"
Trevor said, but his voice broke a little from a lack of sincerity. He had not planned his lies, and they were breaking down as fast as he put them up.
"You don't know your flight number, which hotel you stayed in, or the name of the investigator you spent the last 2 days with. You must think I'm stupid."
Trevor didn't answer. He could only think of the mic in the briefcase and how lucky he was to have it outside. Getting flogged like this was something he'd rather Wes and Chap not hear.
"You've been drinking, haven't you?"
Spicer asked on the attack.
"Yes," Trevor said, a temporary pause in the lying.
"I stopped and bought a beer."
"Or two."
"Yes, two."
Spicer leaned on his elbows, his face halfway across the table.
"I got some bad news for you, Trevor. You're fired."
"What?"
"Terminated, sacked, gone for good."
"You can't fire me."
"I just did, effective immediately, by unanimous vote of the brethren. We're notifying the warden so your name will be removed from the list of attorneys. When you leave today, Trevor, don't come back."
"Why?"
"Lying, drinking too much, sloppy habits, a general lack of trust on behalf of your clients."
It sounded true enough, but Trevor nevertheless took it hard. It had never crossed his mind that they'd have the guts to fire him. He clenched his teeth and asked,
"What about our little enterprise?"
"It's a clean break. You keep your money, we'll keep ours."
"Who'll run it on the outside?"
"We'll worry about that. You can pursue an honest living, if you're able."
"What would you know about an honest living?"
"Why don't you just leave, Trevor? Get up, walk out. It's been lovely."
"Sure," he mumbled,
his thoughts a blur, but two coming to the forefront. First, Spicer had brought no letters, the first time that had happened in many weeks. Second, the cash. What did they need the $5,000 for? Probably to bribe their new lawyer. They'd planned their ambush well, which was always an advantage they held because they had so much time on their hands. Three very bright men with lots of idle time. It wasn't fair. Pride made him stand. He extended a hand and said,
"Sorry it had to happen."
Spicer shook it reluctantly. "Just get out of here," he wanted to say. When they made eye contact for the last time, Trevor said, almost in a whisper,
"Conyers is the man. Very rich, very powerful. He knows about you."
Spicer leapt up like a cat. With their faces just inches apart, he said, also in a whisper,
"Is he watching you?"
Trevor nodded and winked. Then he grabbed the door. He picked up his briefcase without a word to Link. What was he supposed to say to the guard? "Sorry, old boy, but the $1,000 a month in cash you were getting under the table just got cut off." Sad about it? Then ask Judge Spicer here why it happened. But he let it pass. He was reeling and almost dizzy, and the alcohol didn't help. What would he tell Wes and Chap? That was the question of the moment. They would hammer him as soon as they could catch him. He said goodbye to Link and Vince, Mackey, and Rufus up front, same as always, but now for the last time, and walked into the hot sun. Wes and Chap were parked three cars down. They wanted to talk, but played it safe. Trevor ignored them as he tossed his briefcase into the passenger seat and got in the Beetle. The caravan followed him away from the prison and slowly down the highway toward Jacksonville. Their decision to dispose of Trevor had been reached with a maximum of judicial deliberation. They'd spent hours hiding in their little room, studying the Conyers file, until every word of every letter was memorized. They'd walked miles around the track, just the three of them, playing one scenario against another. They ate together, played cards together, all the while whispering new theories of who might be watching their mail. Trevor was the nearest culprit, and the only one they could control. If their victims got sloppy, they could do nothing about it. But if their lawyer had failed to watch his trail, then he had to be fired. He was not the type to evoke a lot of trust in the first place. How many good, busy lawyers would be willing to risk their careers in a gay extortion scheme? The only hesitation in ridding themselves of Trevor was the fear of what he might do with their money. They expected him to steal it, frankly, and they couldn't stop him. But they were willing to run that risk in return for a bigger score with Mr. Aaron Lake. To get to Lake, they felt they had to eliminate Trevor. Spicer gave them the details of their meeting, word for word. Trevor's muted message at the end stunned them. Conyers was watching Trevor. Conyers knew about the Brethren. Did that mean Lake knew about the Brethren? Who was really Conyers now? Why did Trevor whisper this, and why did he leave his briefcase outside the door? With the scrutiny that only a team of bored judges could generate, the questions poured forth. And then the strategies. Trevor was making coffee in his newly cleaned and shined kitchen when Wes and Chap made their quiet entry and came straight at him. "What happened?" Wes asked. They were frowning and gave the impression they'd been fretting for some time. "What do you mean?" Trevor asked, as if things were splendid. "What happened to the mic?" "Oh, that. The guard took the briefcase and kept it outside." They frowned at each other some more. Trevor poured the water into his coffee machine. The fact that it was almost 5 and he was making coffee was duly noted by the agents. "Why did he do that?" "It's routine. About once a month, a guard will keep the briefcase during the visit." "Did he search it?" Trevor busied himself by watching the coffee drip. Absolutely nothing was wrong. "He made his usual quick exam, which I think he does with his eyes closed. He removed the ingoing letters, then took it. The mic was safe." "Did he notice the thick envelopes?" "Of course not. Relax." And the meeting went well. It was routine, except that Spicer had no outgoing mail, which is a bit unusual these days, but it happens. "I'll go back in 2 days and he'll have a stack of letters, and the guard will not even touch the briefcase. You'll get to hear every word. Want some coffee?" They relaxed in unison. "Thanks, but we better go," Chap said. There were reports to make, questions to answer. They started for the door, but Trevor stopped them. "Look, fellas," he said very politely. "I'm perfectly capable of getting dressed by myself and of having a quick bowl of cereal alone, the way I've done it for many years. And I like to open my office here no earlier than 9. Since it's my office, we'll open at 9 and not a minute sooner. You're welcome to be here at that unholy hour, but not at 8:59. Stay away from my house and stay away from this office until 9. Understood?" "Sure," one of them said, and they were gone. It didn't really matter to them. They had bugs crawling all over the office, the house, the car, even the briefcase now. They knew where he bought his toothpaste. Trevor drank the entire pot of coffee and sobered up. Then he began his movements, all carefully planned. He'd started preparing the moment he left Trumbull. He assumed they were watching back there with the boys from the white van. They had the gadgets and the toys, the mics and the bugs, and Wes and Chap certainly knew how to use them. Money was no object. He told himself to believe they knew everything. Just let his imagination run wild and assume they heard every word, followed every turn, and knew exactly where he was at all times. The more paranoid he was, the better his chances of escape. He drove to a mall 16 miles away near Orange Park in the sprawl south of Jacksonville. He roamed and window shopped and ate pizza in a near-empty food court. It was difficult not to dart behind a rack of clothes in a store and wait for the shadows to walk by. But he resisted. In a radio shack, he bought a small cell phone. 1 month of long distance with a local service came with the package, and Trevor had what he needed. He returned home after 9, certain that they were watching. He turned the television on at full volume and made more coffee. In the bathroom, he stuffed his cash into pockets. At midnight, with the house dark and quiet and Trevor evidently asleep, he slipped out the back door and into the night. The air was brisk, the moon full, and he tried his best to look as though he was simply going for a walk on the beach. He wore baggy cargo pants with pockets from the waist down, 2 denim shirts, and an oversized windbreaker with money stuffed inside the liner. In all, Trevor had $80,000 hidden on himself as he wandered aimlessly south, along the edge of the water, just another beachcomber out for a midnight stroll. After a mile, his pace quickened. When he'd gone 3 miles, he was exhausted, but he was in a desperate hurry. Sleep and rest would have to wait. He left the beach and walked into the grungy lobby of a rundown motel. There was no traffic along Highway A1A. Nothing was open except for the motel and a convenience store in the distance. The door rattled enough for the clerk to come to life. A television was on somewhere in the back. A chubby young man of no more than 20 emerged and said, "Good evening. Need a room?" "No, sir," Trevor said as he slowly drew a hand from a pocket and produced a thick roll of bills. He began peeling them off and placing them in a neat row on the counter. "I need a favor." The clerk stared at the money, then rolled his eyes. The beach attracted all kinds. "These rooms ain't that expensive," he said. "What's your name?" Trevor asked. "Oh, I don't know. Let's say it's Sammy Sosa." "All right, Sammy. There's $1,000. It's yours if you'll drive me to Daytona Beach. Take you 90 minutes. "It'll take me 3 hours because I have to drive back." "Whatever. That's more than $300 an hour. When's the last time you made $300 an hour?" "It's been a while, but I can't do it. I run the night shift, you see. My job is to be on duty from 10 until 8. "Who's the boss?" "He's in Atlanta." "When's the last time he stopped by?" "I've never met him." "Of course you haven't. If you owned a dump like this, would you stop by?" "It's not that bad. We have free color TVs and most of the air conditioning works." "It's a dump, Sammy. You can lock that door, drive away, and come back 3 hours later, and no one will ever know it." Sammy looked at the money again. "You running from the law or something?" "No, and I'm not armed. I'm just in a hurry." "So what's up?" "A bad divorce, Sammy. I have a little money, my wife wants it all, and she has some pretty nasty lawyers. I gotta get out of town." "You got money but no car?" "Look, Sammy, you want the deal or not? If you say no, then I'll walk down the street to the convenience store and find somebody smart enough to take my cash." "$2,000. "You'll do it for $2,000? "Yep." The car was worse than Trevor had expected. It was an old Honda, uncleaned by Sammy or any of the previous 5 owners. But A1A was deserted, and the trip to Daytona Beach took exactly 98 minutes. At 3:20 a.m., the Honda stopped in front of an all-night waffle grill, and Trevor got out. He thanked Sammy, said goodbye, and watched him drive away. Inside, he drank coffee and chatted with the waitress long enough to persuade her to go fetch a local phone directory. He ordered pancakes and used his new Radio Shack cell phone to find his way around town. The nearest airport was Daytona Beach International. A few minutes after 4, his cab stopped at the General Aviation Terminal. Dozens of small planes sat in neat rows on the tarmac. He stared at them as the cab drove away. Surely, he told himself, one of them was available for a quick charter. He just needed one, preferably a twin engine. Chapter 29. The back bedroom of the rental had been converted into the meeting room, with 4 folding tables pushed together to make one large one. It was covered with newspapers, magazines, and donut boxes. Every morning at 7:30, Klockner and his team met over coffee and pastries to review the night and plan the day. Wes and Chap were always there, and 6 or 7 others joined them, depending on who was in town from Langley. The technicians from the front room sometimes sat in, though Klockner did not require their attendance. Now that Trevor was on their side, they needed fewer people to track him. Or so they thought. Surveillance detected no movement inside his home before 7:30, which was not altogether unusual for a man who often went to bed drunk and woke up late. At 8, while Klockner was still meeting in the back, a technician called the house under the ruse of a wrong number. After 3 rings, the recorder came on, and Trevor announced he was not in, please leave a message. This happened occasionally when he was trying to sleep late, but it usually worked well enough to roust him from bed. Klockner was notified at 8:30 that the house was completely still. No shower, no radio, no television, no stereo, not a sound from the normal routine. It was entirely possible he'd gotten drunk at home by himself, but they knew he had not spent last night at Pete's. He'd gone to a mall and arrived home apparently sober. "He could be sleeping," Klockner said, unconcerned. "Where's his car?" "In his driveway." At 9, Wes and Chap knocked on Trevor's door, then opened it when there was no answer. The rental sprang to life when they reported there was no sign of him and that his car was still there. Without panic, Klockner sent people to the beach, to the coffee shops near the Sea Turtle, even to Pete's, which was not yet open. They canvassed the area around his house and office, by foot and by car, and saw nothing. At 10, Klockner called DeVille at Langley. "The lawyer's missing," was the message. Every flight to Nassau was checked. Nothing turned up. No sign of a Trevor Carson. DeVille's contact in Bahamian Customs could not be located, nor could he find the banking supervisor they'd been bribing. Teddy Maynard was in the middle of a briefing on North Korean troop movements when he was interrupted by an urgent message that Trevor Carson, their drunken lawyer in Neptune Beach, Florida, was missing.
"How can you lose a fool like him?" Teddy growled at DeVille in a rare display of anger.
"I don't know.
I don't believe this."
"Sorry, Teddy." Teddy shifted his weight and grimaced from the pain.
"Find him, damn it,"
he hissed. The plane was a Beech Baron, a twin engine owned by some doctors and chartered by Eddie, the pilot Trevor had coaxed out of bed at 6 a.m. with the promise of cash on the spot and more under the table. The official quote was $2,200 for a round trip between Daytona Beach and Nassau, 2 hours each way, total of 4 at $400 an hour, plus some fees for landing and immigration and pilot downtime. Trevor kicked in another $2,000 for Eddie's pocket if the trip took place immediately. The Geneva Trust Bank in downtown Nassau opened at 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and Trevor was waiting when the doors were unlocked. He barged into the office of Mr. Brashears and demanded immediate assistance. He had almost $1 million in his account, $900,000 from Mr. Al Conyers through Wes and Chap, about $68,000 from his dealings with the Brethren. With one eye on the door, he pressed Brashears to help him move the money, and quickly. The money was owned by Trevor Carson and no one else. Brashears had no choice. There was a bank in Bermuda managed by a friend of his, which suited Trevor just fine. He didn't trust Brashears, and he planned to keep moving the money until he felt safe. For a moment, Trevor cast a lustful eye at the account of Boomer Realty, currently with a balance of $189,000 and change. It was within his power during that fleeting moment to snatch their money, too. They were nothing but felons, Beach, Yarber, the odious Spicer, all crooks, and they'd had the arrogance to fire him. They had forced him to run. He tried to hate them enough to take their money, but as he wavered back and forth, he felt a soft spot for them. Three old men wasting away in prison. $1 million was enough. Besides, he was in a hurry. If Wes and Chap suddenly charged in with guns, it wouldn't have surprised him. He thanked Brashears and ran from the building. When the Beech Baron lifted off the runway at Nassau International, Trevor couldn't help but laugh. He laughed at the heist, at the getaway, at his luck, at Wes and Chap and their rich client, now minus $1 million, at his shabby little law office, now mercifully idle. He laughed at his past and at his glorious future. At 3,000 feet, he gazed downward at the still blue waters of the Caribbean. A lonely sailboat rocked along, its captain at the wheel, a scantily clad lady nearby. That would be him down there in just a few short days. He found a beer in a carry-on cooler. He drank it and fell sound asleep. They landed on the island of Eleuthera, a place Trevor had seen in a travel magazine he'd bought the night before. There were beaches and hotels and all the water sports. He paid Eddie in cash, then waited an hour at the small airport for a taxi to happen by. He bought clothes at a tourist shop in Governor's Harbor, then walked to a hotel on the beach. He was amused at how quickly he stopped watching the shadows. Sure, Mr. Conyers had plenty of money, but no one could afford a secret army big enough to track someone through the Bahamas. His future would be one of sheer delight. He would not ruin it by looking over his shoulder. He drank rum by the pool as fast as the barmaid could bring it. At the age of 48, Trevor Carson welcomed his new life in pretty much the same condition he'd left his old one. The law office of Trevor Carson opened on time and proceeded as if nothing was amiss. Its owner had fled, but its paralegal and office manager were on duty to take care of any business that might unexpectedly develop. They listened in all the right places and heard nothing. The phone rang twice before noon, two misguided inquiries from souls lost in the yellow pages. Not a single client needed Trevor. Not a single friend called to say hello. Wes and Chap busied themselves by going through the few drawers and files they had not yet inspected. Nothing of consequence was found. Another crew combed every inch of Trevor's house, primarily looking for the cash he'd been paid. Not surprisingly, they didn't find it. The cheap briefcase was in a closet, empty. There was no trail. Trevor had just walked away with his cash. The Bahamian banking official was tracked to New York, where he was visiting on government business. He was reluctant to get involved from such a long distance, but he eventually made his calls. Around 1 p.m., it was confirmed that the money had been moved. Its owner had done so in person, and the official would divulge nothing else. Where did the money go? It was moved by wire, and that's all he would tell DeVille. His country's banking reputation depended upon secrecy, and he could reveal only so much. He was corrupt, but he did have his limits. U.S. Customs cooperated after some initial reluctance. Trevor's passport had been scanned at Nassau International early that morning, and so far he had not left the Bahamas, at least not officially. His passport was red-listed. If he used it to enter another country, U.S. Customs would know it within 2 hours. DeVille delivered a quick update to Teddy and York, his fourth of the day, then hung around for further instructions. "He'll make a mistake," York said. "He'll use his passport somewhere and we'll catch him. He doesn't know who's chasing him." Teddy seethed but said nothing. His agency had toppled governments and killed kings, yet he was constantly amazed at how the little things often got botched. One bumbling and witless lawyer from Neptune Beach slipped through their net while a dozen people were supposed to be watching. He thought he was beyond surprises. The lawyer was to be their link, their bridge to the inside of Trumbull. For $1 million, they thought they could trust him. There'd been no contingency plan for his sudden flight. Now they were scrambling to develop one. "We need someone inside the prison," Teddy said. "We're close," DeVille answered. "We're working with Justice and the Bureau of Prisons." "How close?" "Well, in light of what's happened today, I think we can have a man there inside Trumbull within 48 hours.
"Who is he?"
"His name is Argro, 11 years with the agency, age 39, solid credentials."
"His story?"
"He'll transfer into Trumbull from a federal prison in the Virgin Islands. His paperwork will be cleared by the Bureau here in Washington, so the warden down there won't ask any questions. He's just another federal prisoner who requested a transfer."
"And he's ready to go?"
"Almost, 48 hours.
"Do it now."
DeVille left, again with the burden of a difficult task that suddenly had to be done overnight.
"We have to find out how much they know," Teddy said, almost in a mumble.
"Yes, but we have no reason to believe they suspect anything," York said. "I've read all their mail. There's nothing to indicate they're particularly excited about Conyers. He's just one of their potential victims. We bought the lawyer to stop him from snooping around behind Conyers' post office box. He's off in the Bahamas now, drunk with his money. So he's not a threat."
"But we still dispose of him," Teddy said. It was not a question.
"Of course."
"I'll feel better when he's gone," Teddy said.
A guard with a uniform but no gun entered the law library in mid-afternoon. He first encountered Joe Roy Spicer, who was by the door to the chamber. "The warden would like to see you," the guard said. "You and Mr. Yarber and Mr. Beach."
"What's this about?"
Spicer asked. He was reading an old copy of Field and Stream.
None of my business. He wants you now, up front. Tell him we're busy. I ain't telling him nothing. Let's go.
They followed him to the administration building, picking up other guards along the way, until a regular entourage emerged from the elevator and stood before the warden's secretary. She, and she alone, somehow managed to escort the brethren into the big office where Emmett Brune was waiting. When she was gone, he said abruptly, "I have been notified by the FBI that your lawyer is missing." No visible response from the three, but each instantly thought about the money hidden offshore. He continued, "He disappeared this morning, and there's some money missing. I don't have the details." Whose money? They wanted to ask. No one knew about their hidden funds. Had Trevor stolen from someone else? "Why are you telling us?" Beach asked. The real reason was that the Justice Department in Washington had asked Brune to inform the three of the latest news. But the reason he gave was, "Just thought you'd want to know in case you needed to call him." They'd fired Trevor the day before and had not yet informed the administration that he was no longer their attorney of record. "What are we going to do for a lawyer?" Spicer asked, as if life couldn't go on. "That's your problem. Frankly, I'd say you gentlemen have had enough legal counsel to last you many years." "What if he contacts us?" Yarber asked, knowing full well they'd never hear from Trevor again. "You ought to notify me immediately." They agreed to do so, whatever the warden wanted. He excused them. Buster's escape was less complicated than a trip to the grocery. They waited until the next morning, until breakfast was over and most of the inmates were busy with their menial jobs. Yarber and Beach were on the track, walking an eighth of a mile apart so that one was always watching the prison while the other watched the woods in the distance. Spicer loitered near the basketball court on the lookout for guards. With no fences or towers or pressing security concerns, guards were not that critical at Trumbull. Spicer saw none. Buster was lost in the whining noise of his weed eater, which he slowly worked toward the track. He took a break to wipe his face and look around. Spicer, from 50 yards away, heard the engine die. He turned and quickly gave a thumbs up, the sign to do it quickly. Buster stepped onto the track, caught up with Yarber, and for a few steps they walked together. "Are you sure you want to do this?" Yarber asked.
"Yes, I'm positive."
The kid appeared calm and ready.
"Then do it now. Pace yourself. Be cool."
"Thanks, Finn."
"Don't get caught, son."
"No way."
At the turn, Buster kept walking. Off the track, across the freshly cut grass, 100 yards to some brush, then he was gone. Beach and Yarber saw him go, then turned to watch the prison. Spicer was calmly walking toward them. There was no sign of alarm around the courtyards or dorms or any of the other buildings on the prison grounds. Not a guard in sight. They walked 3 miles, 12 laps, at the leisurely pace of 15 minutes per mile, and when they'd had enough, they retired to the coolness of the chamber to relax and listen for news of the escape. It would be hours before they heard a word. Buster's pace was much faster. Once into the woods, he began to jog without looking back. Watching the sun, he moved due south for half an hour. The woods were not thick. The undergrowth was thin and did not slow him. He passed a deer stand 20 feet up in an oak tree and soon found a trail that ran to the southwest. In his left front pants pocket, he had $2,000 cash, given to him by Finn Yarber. In his other front pocket, he had a map Beach had drawn by hand. And in his rear pocket, he had a yellow envelope addressed to a man named Al Conyers in Chevy Chase, Maryland. All three were important, but the envelope had received the most attention from the brethren. After an hour, he stopped to rest and to listen. Highway 30 was his first landmark. It ran east and west, and Beach figured he would find it within 2 hours. He heard nothing and started running again. He had to pace himself. There was a chance his absence would be noticed just after lunch, when the guards sometimes walked the grounds in a very casual inspection. If one of them thought to look for Buster, then other questions might follow. But after 2 weeks of watching the guards, neither Buster nor any of the brethren thought this was a possibility. So he had at least 4 hours, and probably a lot more, because his workday ended at 5 when he turned in his weed eater. When he didn't show, they'd start looking around the prison. After 2 hours of that, they'd notify the surrounding police agencies that another one had walked away from Trumbull. They were never armed and dangerous, and no one got too excited. No search parties, no bloodhounds, no helicopters hovering over the woods. The county sheriff and his deputies would patrol the main roads and warn the citizens to lock their doors. The escapee's name went into a national computer. They watched his home and watched his girlfriend, and they waited for him to do something stupid. After 90 minutes of freedom, Buster stopped for a moment and heard the whine of an 18-wheeler not far away. The woods stopped abruptly at a right-of-way ditch, and there was the highway. According to Beach's map, the nearest town was several miles to the west. The plan was to hike along the highway, dodging traffic by using ditches and bridges, until civilization in some form was found. Buster wore the standard prison issue of khaki pants and an olive-colored short-sleeve shirt, both darkened with sweat. The locals knew what the prisoners wore, and if he were spotted walking down Highway 30, someone would call the sheriff. Get to town, Beach and Spicer had told him, and find different clothes. Then pay cash for a bus ticket and never stop running. It took him 3 hours of ducking behind trees and jumping over roadside ditches before he saw the first buildings. He moved away from the highway and cut through a hayfield. A dog growled at him as he stepped onto a street lined with house trailers. Behind one of them, he noticed a clothesline with someone's laundry hanging in the windless air. He took a red and white pullover and threw away his olive shirt. Downtown was nothing more than 2 blocks of stores, a couple of gas stations, a bank, some sort of town hall, and a post office. He bought denim shorts, a t-shirt, and a pair of boots at a discount store and changed in the employee restroom. He found the post office inside the town hall. He smiled and thanked his friends at Trumbull as he dropped their precious envelope into the out-of-town slot. Buster caught a bus to Gainesville, where he purchased for $480 the right to ride a bus anywhere in the United States for 60 days. He headed west. He wanted to get lost in Mexico. Chapter 30. The Pennsylvania primary on April 25th was to be Governor Terry's last mighty effort. Undaunted by his dismal showing in the debate there 2 weeks earlier, he campaigned with great enthusiasm, but with very little money. "Lake has it all," he proclaimed at every stop, feigning pride at being the pauper. He did not leave the state for 11 straight days. Reduced to traveling in a large Winnebago camper, he ate his meals in the homes of supporters, stayed in cheap motels, and worked himself ragged, shaking hands and walking neighborhoods. "Let's talk about the issues," he pleaded, "not about money." Lake, too, worked very hard in Pennsylvania. His jet traveled 10 times faster than Terry's RV. Lake shook more hands, made more speeches, and he certainly spent more money. The result was predictable. Lake received 71% of the vote, a landslide so embarrassing to Terry that he openly talked about quitting. But he vowed to hang on for at least another week, until the Indiana primary. His staff had left him. He was $11 million in debt. He'd been evicted from his campaign headquarters in Arlington. Yet, he wanted the good people of Indiana to have the opportunity to see his name on the ballot. And who knew? Lake's shiny new jet might catch on fire just like the previous one. Terry licked his rather deep wounds, and the day after the primary, he promised to fight on. Lake almost felt sorry for him, and he sort of admired his determination to endure until the convention. But Lake, along with everybody else, could do the math. Lake needed just 40 more delegates to lock up the nomination, and there were almost 500 still out there. The race was over. After Pennsylvania, newspapers across the country confirmed his nomination. His happy, handsome face was everywhere, a political miracle. He was praised by many as a symbol of why the system works, an unknown with a message who came from nowhere and captured the attention of the people. Lake's campaign gave hope to every person who dreamed of running for president. It didn't take months of pounding the back roads of Iowa. Skip New Hampshire. It was such a small state anyway. And he was condemned for buying his nomination. Before Pennsylvania, it was estimated he'd spent $40 million. A more precise number was difficult because the money was being burned on so many fronts. Another $20 million had been spent by DPAC and half a dozen other high-powered lobbying groups, all working on Lake's behalf. No other candidate in history had spent anything close. The criticism stung Lake, and it dogged him day and night. But he'd rather have the money and the nomination than suffer the alternative. Big money was hardly taboo. Online entrepreneurs were making billions. The federal government, of all bumbling entities, was showing a surplus. Nearly everybody had a job and an affordable mortgage and a couple of cars. Lake's nonstop polling led him to believe that the big money was not yet an issue with the voters. In a November matchup against the vice president, Lake was now practically even. He once again returned to Washington from the wars of the West as a triumphant hero. Aaron Lake, lowly congressman from Arizona, was now the man of the hour. Over a quiet and very long breakfast, the brethren read the Jacksonville Morning Paper, the only one allowed inside Trumbull. They were very happy for Aaron Lake. In fact, they were thrilled with his nomination. They were now among his most ardent supporters. Run, Aaron, run. The news of Buster's walk to freedom had created hardly a stir. Good for him, the inmates were saying. He was just a kid with a long sentence. Run, Buster, run. The escape wasn't mentioned in the morning paper. They passed it around, reading every word but the want ads and the obituaries. They were waiting now. No more letters would be written, none would be brought in, because they'd lost their courier. Their little scam was on hold until they heard from Mr. Lake. Wilson Argrow arrived at Trumbull in an unmarked green van, handcuffed, with two marshals pulling at his elbows. He'd flown with his escorts from Miami to Jacksonville, of course at the expense of the taxpayers. According to his paperwork, he had served 4 months of a 60-month sentence for bank fraud. He had requested a transfer for reasons that were not clear, but his reasons were of no concern to anyone at Trumbull. He was just another low-security prisoner in the federal system. They moved around all the time. He was 39 years old, divorced, college-educated, and his home address for prison records was in Coral Gables, Florida. His real name was Kenny Sands, an 11-year veteran of the CIA, and though he'd never seen the inside of a prison, he'd had much tougher assignments than Trumbull. He'd be there a month or two, then request another transfer. Argrow maintained the cool facade of an old prison hand as he was processed. But his stomach churned. He'd been assured that violence was not tolerated at Trumbull, and he could certainly take care of himself. But prison was prison. He suffered through a one-hour orientation by an assistant warden, then was given a quick tour of the grounds. He began to relax when he saw Trumbull for himself. The guards had no guns, and most of the inmates looked rather harmless. His cellmate was an old man with a spotty white beard, a career criminal who'd seen many prisons and loved Trumbull. He told Argrow he planned to die there. The man took Argro to lunch and explained the vagaries of the menu. He showed him the game room, where groups of thick men bunched around folding tables studying their cards, every one with a cigarette stuck to the lips.
"Gambling's illegal," his cellmate said with a wink.
They walked to the lifting area outdoors, where the younger men sweated in the sun, polishing their tans while their muscles expanded. He pointed to the track in the distance and said,
"You gotta love the federal government."
He showed Argro the library, a place he never visited, and he pointed to a corner and said,
"That's the law library."
"Who uses it?" Argro asked.
"We usually have some lawyers here. Right now we have some judges, too."
"Judges?"
"Three of them."
The old man had no interest in the library. Argro followed him to the chapel, then around the grounds again. Argro thanked him for the tour, then excused himself and returned to the library, which was empty except for an inmate mopping a floor. Argro went to the corner and opened a door to the law library. Joe Roy Spicer looked up from his magazine and saw a man he'd never seen before.
"Looking for something?"
he asked, with no effort at being helpful. Argro recognized the face from the file. An ex-justice of the peace caught stealing bingo profits. What a lowlife. "I'm new," he said, forcing a smile. "Just got here. This is the law library?"
"It is."
"I guess anybody can use it, huh?"
"I guess," Spicer said. "You a lawyer?"
"Nope, a banker." A few months earlier, Spicer would have hustled him for some legal work, under the table, of course. But not now. They no longer needed the nickel-and-dime stuff. Argro looked around and did not see Beach and Yarber. He excused himself and returned to his room. Contact was made. Lake's plan to rid himself of any memories of Ricky and their ill-fated correspondence depended upon someone else. He, Lake, was simply too scared and too famous to sneak away again in the middle of the night in a disguise in the back of a taxi, dashing through the suburbs to an all-night mailbox. The risks were too great. Plus, he seriously doubted if he could shake the Secret Service anymore. He couldn't count the number of agents now assigned to protect him. Count hell. He couldn't see them all. The young lady's name was Jane. She'd joined the campaign in Wisconsin and had quickly worked her way into the inner circle. A volunteer at first, she now earned $55,000 a year as a personal aide to Mr. Lake, who trusted her completely. She seldom left his side, and they'd already had two little chats about Jane's future job in the White House. At the right moment, Lake would give Jane the key to the box rented by Mr. Al Conyers and instruct her to get the mail, close out the rental, and leave no forwarding address. He would tell her it was a box he'd rented in an effort to monitor the sale of classified defense contracts back when he was convinced the Iranians were buying data they should never see. Or some such tale. She would believe him because she wanted to believe him. If he were incredibly lucky, there would be no letter from Ricky. The box would be forever closed. And if a letter was waiting for Jane, and if she was the least bit curious, Lake would simply tell her he had no idea who the person was. She would ask nothing further. Blind allegiance was her strong suit. He waited for the right moment. He waited too long. Chapter 31. It arrived safely with a million other letters. Tons of paperwork shipped into the capital to sustain the government for one more day. It was sorted by zip code, then by street. 3 days after Buster dropped it off, Ricky's last letter to Al Conyers made it to Chevy Chase.
This book is continued on Disc 9.